This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and you're tuned in to Ringgit and Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. The first 3 months of 2018 marked the worst quarter for U.S. stocks since 2015. Then April saw its worst start for U.S. equities since the Great Depression in 1929. And all this week, markets swung wildly as investors digested the potential of a trade war between the U.S. and China. How can we, as investors, keep our calm in volatile times? Recently, Tan Chung Han and Brian Fernandez spoke to Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation and Securities Commission, a licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management Services Berhad.
Good morning, Rajan, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Han, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So, Rajan, amidst all this volatility, how can we keep our personal financial goals intact? I mean, one strategy that immediately comes to mind is to buy the dips, correct?
Yes, I think that makes sense, but I would say buy it intelligently. Now, before I go into very specific guidelines as to how people can possibly, over the long haul, grow wealthier from increased volatility, I think it's just very, very important to acknowledge the fact that a period of volatility is absolutely terrifying for market newbies, for young people who've never invested, or even slightly older people who also have never invested. It is, however, volatility is, however, less terrifying for those who have gone through preferably several boom and bust cycles.
So, Rajan, there's an age bias there. So if you've been through several dips and up markets as well, you basically probably have a stronger stomach for the risk.
Yes.
So it's not good enough to just look at the historical chart. You've got to experience it.
That has been my experience, yeah. Because you've got to feel the visceral fear. You've got to... let me give you my history, okay? Mm. My memory of market collapses personally, okay, goes back more than 30 years to Black Monday, sometime in October 1987. I was actually in London then. In 87, I was 23 years old. So I woke up that morning. A hurricane had hit London the night before. And so I went out for a run, and I couldn't figure out why I was hurtling over all these collapsed logs. Now, as a result of the hurricane, many trains were not running into London, and many traders were not able to get in to their trading desks. Mm-hmm. Now, the U.S. had a massive collapse, and it was slightly tempered in Europe because people couldn't get to their trading stations. Now, that particular drop was terrifying. And as you begin to roll through history, because listeners are of different ages, those of us who are old enough to remember the Asian financial crisis, we remember the terrifying fear, 1997-1998. In Malaysia, it got very, very bad until on September 1st, 1998, Prime Minister Mahathir then ring-fenced the entire country with capital controls. The moment he did that, there was this collective sigh of relief.
Mm. For listeners who were not there or not old enough to remember, essentially it gave business people the ability to plan. There was so much uncertainty at that prior to capital controls. Basically, people didn't know how to move forward.
Absolutely. You're very, very right. True. It's very, very, you are right, and it is very, very true. Now, another thing that Mahathir did the moment capital controls were put in place was to gradually, instruct Bank Negara to bring down interest rates. Now, for those who understand markets a little bit, when interest rates come down, bond prices go up. Also, when interest rates come down, the business environment is more accommodative and the share market has a tendency to do very well as well. So we ended up in a period of recovery. Now, when he draconianly, is that a word? Anyway, through draconian measures, put in place these capital controls, which lasted for several years, You know, as usual, he got lambasted by the
IMF,
outsiders. Absolutely.
World Bank.
Absolutely.
Everyone.
And
literally.
Many years later, the IMF turned around and said, actually, you got it right. Yeah, so that's very impressive. No, so that's 97, 98. And then I remember I was working on a book I was co-writing with the then senior management of KL Mutual at the time. It was the second book in the series. In 98, we worked on a book on financial planning. And in 2000, we were working on a book on equity investments. Now, during this period, as we are talking about fundamental equity investments and what needs to be done, the market, especially in the US, seemed to have thrown away the rule book, because now people were not talking about profits. They were talking about eyeballs, because it was the dawn of the internet era.
The dot-com.
Dot-com. Yeah. Boom and very much bust, essentially. So I remember doing a lot of the writing and having these meetings with my co-authors at the time, Edmund Chia and Wong Bun Choi, then of KL Mutual. And we were discussing how true value is found in a particular investment in a particular company. And we couldn't make sense of what was going on in the dot-com bubble. But as the writing continued, the dot-com bubble burst. And this happened in March of 2000.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, March of 2000. Thank
March,
you very
April,
much. March,
April.
March. It was March 2000, yeah. And then it came down, and then there was a bit of a recovery. And then, of course, everyone remembers, if you're old enough, 9/11, September 11th, 2001. And at that time, the chairman of the U.S. Fed, Alan Greenspan, basically came and he turned on the floodgates. And to make sure that the markets didn't collapse, he just flooded the system with liquidity. We may still be paying the price for that.
Given all those experiences that you highlighted, and I guess I'm envious because the both of you have far more, or have spent many more years here on Earth than I have. So you talk about 1987, 1998, dot-com, 2000, you know, September 11, 2001. So for perhaps listeners who may not have had the benefit of such experiences, or as you described it, experience that visceral fear, what are some active measures that we can do to steel ourselves for, you know, anticipated future volatility?
Sure. It's a very good question, Han. Thanks. Before I answer that, I want to at least acknowledge the fact that we then ended up with a global financial crisis.
08, 09.
Yeah. 08, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually began, I think, third quarter 07, but no one felt it, because it was just the beginning of subprime cracking. But 08, 09 was terrifying. Mm. The truth of the matter is, markets rise, markets fall. And I believe, in general, and there is definitely an age bias here, but far more important than age, I think, is internal fortitude. So you could have an older, nervous individual who fares less well than a younger person who historically and maybe intellectually understands that markets rise and fall. And they also understand that they need to be able to re-engineer their thinking. So in general, there is an age bias. So I'll just say this. Older, hopefully calmer investors, fund managers, financial planners are actually adopting an opportunistic, calmer frame of mind because of one major reason.
Being?
That major reason is market shocks always fade away eventually. This is the truth. Now, there's an old saying that apparently has come down to us from an ancient unknown Persian king. So Persia, Iran, okay, but long ago, Persian king. The phrase is one that most of us know. This too shall pass. This too shall pass. Now, what normally happens is that long periods of wild volatility usually cause immense wealth transfers from weak hands to strong hands.
Now, what's weak hands and strong hands? What's that all about?
Well, that's a great question there, Brian, and we will discuss that after the break, which too shall pass. And we'll hear more from Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation and Securities Commission Licensed Financial Planner with Manulife Asset Management Services Berhad. We'll be back with more right here on Ringgit and Sense.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for staying with us here on Ringgit and Sense. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is Brian Fernandez. And we have the pleasure of having Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation and the Securities Commission Licensed Financial Planner with Manulife Asset Management Services Berhad. At the end of the first half, we left off with this question, right? What's the difference between weak hands and strong hands? Because you spoke about how during times of volatility, we see this transfer of wealth from those weak hands to the strong hands. Make those distinctions for us.
Sure, will do. Now, it's very obvious that most people are somewhat disturbed by the very clear trend that over the long haul, the rich grow richer and the poor grow poorer. In terms of absolute wealth, if you look at the history of man and the history of money over thousands of years, when we talk about the poor getting poorer, it's actually in relative terms, not in absolute terms. Mm. Even the very poorest of the urban poor in Kuala Lumpur would probably have access to an Astro dish, one would imagine. And they may actually have several sets of clothing. And if you compare what they've got to the kings and queens of Europe 800 years ago, you'd wake up and say, wow, poor are doing rather well today. So it's not an absolute difference.
It's relative.
Yeah, it's relative. And of course, you know, you may earn ₹1 million a year. I wish I earned ₹1 million a year. But a person may earn ₹1 million a year, and you may look at someone who earns ₹10 million a year and say, I wish I was him. So there's always this sense of covetousness and greed, and that's not really a good thing. Mm. But in general, volatility does transfer wealth from weak hands to strong hands. One measure of weak strong is how much money do you have. But a better measure is actually how much internal fortitude do you have. Yet another measure is how well prepared you are. Mm. So
speaking about being prepared, Rajan, what can we do to be prepared? How do we diversify our assets, for example?
Good question, Brian. I actually have thought about this, and I would recommend using or heeding perhaps four guidelines. So if you want, I'll run through those.
Sure.
Number one, to borrow a philosophy from the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, I would recommend, particularly with investing in stocks and in unit trusts, not so much for property. Property, most of us would borrow money intelligently, so that's fine. But when it comes to stocks and unit trusts in particular, I would say only use your own money to invest. Do not borrow or trade on margin.
So you don't believe in leveraging at all?
For stocks? Or unit trusts, I don't, not at all. And I have never used margin for that purpose. The second guideline is I would say that don't put all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. Diversify, and I would recommend that you diversify across three dimensions. Those three are, number one, you should diversify across different asset classes. Mm-hmm. Possible asset classes to look at would be cash. You could have money in the bank, or you could put money in money market funds. You could have money in fixed income. That means you have money directly in bonds or more likely in bond funds. Mm-hmm. You could have money in equities, which means you could have money directly in stocks or in equity funds. You could have money in investment real estate. You could go out and buy a house or a warehouse or a shop lot. Or if you want immediate diversification, you could buy REITs directly that are listed in the market, or you could buy a REIT fund. Mm. So the fourth asset class is investment real estate. And the fifth is, in general, the alternative investment space. There are lots of things in alts, hedge funds, which people probably have to go to Singapore for. I don't think they are widely available in Malaysia.
Cryptocurrency. Yeah.
No, not at all. I'm actually very, very leery of cryptocurrencies. Mm. But I may be wrong. But let me just cover the last bit in terms of alternative investments. Mm. So I don't include crypto personally. Hedge funds would be one, but they're not available in Malaysia. What you could look at would be derivatives, but Warren Buffett again has referred to these as toxic weapons of mass destruction. Yes. You could look at structured products, you could look at foreign currency, all kinds of things. But my favorite investment option within the alternative space is commodities. I love hard commodities. I love soft commodities. For myself and for my clients, I actually invest in a global commodity fund.
Okay.
So that was just the first dimension I was talking about. Mm-hmm. The second dimension of diversification would be to diversify across geographic regions. Don't just focus on Malaysia. Don't just focus on China. Don't just focus on the US. Don't just focus on Japan. As far as you possibly can, spread your risk around the world as much as you can. Mm. And the third area of diversification, the third dimension, if you like, is diversification across the timeline. I love dollar cost averaging. I think if it allows you to invest steadily over many, many years, that's a wise way to do it. And even if you have a great deal of money to start with, let's say you have a durian runtuh situation and someone gives you ₱1 million and it lands on your lap, you could then go and say, okay, fine, risk on investments like equities or investment real estate commodities will actually give me the best return. So I'll just plonk everything in today. Very unwise. Mm. Because what happens if we end up with a mega market collapse and the market stays down for 3 years? You've lost an opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I think it's much wiser to take your large amount of money, put it in things that are relatively safe, like cash and fixed income, and to gradually bleed your money over many years.
Mm. So in a windfall situation like that, and that's an interesting thing because that's kind of counterintuitive to what people would normally think. Let's go and invest straight away and say use an asset allocation strategy and invest all my money given this sort of strategy. So you are then, what sort of timeline do you think you would recommend? 12 months, 24 months, say for an amount like that?
When I sit down with my clients and I explain this, I would say, it's not that I don't put some significant amount of money into the risk on asset classes right now. But let's say we put in between 20 and 50% right now, and the rest, 50 to 80% is kept on standby. Then I'll try and assess the client. And if the client is aggressive, I may move the money over a short period, say over 24 months, 2 years. If the client is moderate, I would do it maybe over 3 years. If the client is super conservative, I may actually take 5 years to do it.
And the reason I asked you this, Rajan, was really because the windfall doesn't come from a lottery ticket. For a lot of people, the windfall may come either from, for example, selling a property where they've got capital appreciation and then suddenly they've got all this cash in front of them. The second thing is also when people reach 55 and they suddenly want to, you know, they've all this money from EPF that they have and the urge is to go out and spend it or invest it because they think they can do better than the EPF. So that was one of the reasons why I said, how do we bleed this across time?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, for a lot of people with regard to EPF, I think if you don't know what you're doing, you're probably better off leaving your money in EPF. If you do know what you're doing, you might want to, I mean, it depends on how you feel about prospects for the whole country as a whole. In general. But if you want to take your money out of EPF, then you want to make sure that you invest it intelligently. Or you may want to split your bets and you may decide to keep some money in EPF and take some money out and attempt. There's never any guarantee outside. Mm. EPF by law must maintain the integrity of each ringgit that goes in and it must pay a minimum of 2.5%.
Yeah, and also I believe 2 percentage points over inflation over a rolling 3-year yes. period as well. Real quick with the little time that we have left, Rajan. So you mentioned 4 guidelines. Let me just recap. First one, use only your money to invest in stocks and unit trusts. 2, diversify across asset classes, geographic locations, and timeline. What are the remaining 2 guidelines that we have?
Okay. Number 3, always maintain separate liquidity for your living expenses. Mm-hmm. At the very least, put in place a general emergency buffer fund. And if you can, even start up maybe a career buffer fund that will allow you to weather things in case suddenly you get VSS'd. Or a medical and surgical fund so that, let's say, you should have insurance to take care of this, but sometimes insurance may take some time or for some reason there may be an exclusion. You may be relying on EPF account too to pay out, but you may find that they don't release the money. Mm-hmm. Having your own money will reduce your stress. Mm-hmm. Unlike houses, cars need to be changed. I believe in keeping cars a long time, but even then, after 10 years, you really probably want to consider changing. Mm-hmm. Having the money there is good. Most of us like to go on vacations. Having money set aside is useful. Household things tend to break down. So that's 3. Always maintain separate liquidity pools for living expenses. Mm. And the last thing is, and this is very important, when buying on the dips, and Han, this is what you were talking about earlier because of the increased volatility. When buying on the dips or even trimming your positions, during market surges, when the markets go up, always do so in percentage terms, not in absolute terms. Let me give you a simple example. Let's say you have a certain amount of money invested in the market, and let's say you have some liquidity outside, maybe 100,000 ringgit outside. Let's say the market dips by quite a bit, and you wish to put 20,000 ringgit. By all means, you can do that. And then say the market dips again and say, okay, I'm going to do another 20. The trouble is, with this approach, all you can do is five times and you're out of cash.
That's right. Yep.
But if you change the strategy and instead of going for absolute 20,000, 20,000, 20,000, 20,000, 20,000, if instead of that you say every time there's a dip, I will move 20% of available liquidity. Then what happens is market dips, you're moving 20% of the 100,000 I said, it's 20,000. Market dips again, hypothetically, let's say. You've now got 80,000 plus a little bit of growth because chances are this is in cash. You're getting some growth, say, from a money market fund or from your FDs or whatever.
Mm.
Then you take 20% of the 80,000. So that's maybe 16,000 or 16,000 and a bit. And then the market dips again. And then now you're left with 60,000 plus. And you take 20,000 and 12,000. If you think about this, you'll never run out of money.
That's
because
right.
every
yes.
time you're pulling cash out, you're always leaving 80% residual. And so hopefully that will help people, regardless of whether they have a lot of money or whether they're very young or very old, to just organize their lives according to sound financial planning principles so that as this particular episode of high volatility works its way through, if people are already ready, hopefully they can be among the strong to benefit. But even if they miss the boat now, they can strengthen their personal finances. Because the next round of volatility will come, and it'll be great.
And you'll be among the stronger hands as opposed to the weaker hands then, hopefully.
Hopefully, yes.
All right, thank you so much for those tips and insights there. That was Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation and the Securities Commission Licensed Financial Planner with Manulife Asset Management Services Berhad. Hi, I'm Tan Chung Han and with Brian Fernandez. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Ringgit and Sense right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.